This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the Television Academy changes its Emmy rules to make them more fair and less embarrassing. And can't tell the difference between a voice booth and a phone booth? You will when we're done giving voiceover the once-over. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Better than Botox, it's The Business from NPR. It was another week of old media rushing into the arms of new media. NBC Universal and News Corp jumped into bed last week with several major internet companies to distribute their TV shows, video clips, and films online, hoping, for once, to control their programming and stifle competition from YouTube. Rather than birth a brand new portal online, the NBC Universal and News Corp shows will be available through several websites that already do brisk traffic, including Yahoo, AOL, Microsoft's MSN, and MySpace. But the problem with being a media swinger is that sometimes the wife gets jealous. Disney thought it was being really clever when it made a deal to distribute its movies online. But now they're being sued by Starz Entertainment because the cable channel says they promised their films to Starz exclusively. As these companies try to expand into the new media universe, they'd better not forget that old-timey saying, "You gotta dance with the one that brung you." Finally, some happy legal news from Malaysia last week. Lucky and Flo, the Motion Picture Association's DVD-sniffing black Labrador retrievers, led investigators to warehouses filled with an estimated 1 million copies of pirated movies and computer games. 6 arrests, a stash valued at $2.8 million, and 90 optical disc burners are now out of commission. After a bounty was put on their furry little heads, and I'm not making this up, Lucky and Flo were moved to a safe house. Well, a safe doghouse. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later, ever been told you've got a face for radio? Well, have we got a job for you. But next, the Television Academy is bursting, but not with pride. Last year, Ellen Burstyn won an Emmy for her performance in the HBO movie Mrs. Harris. This caused no end of embarrassment to the voting members of the TV Academy, who clearly didn't see the movie. Why? Because Ms. Burstyn appears on screen for less than 14 seconds. Here's her performance in its entirety.
I had my own money, so he was more relaxed with me. Though I don't know if it can be said that Herman was relaxed with any woman. His favorite piece of music was the film score from Cleopatra.
How Ellen Burstyn managed to win an Emmy in this instance is an interesting story, and it caused the Academy to institute what is unfortunately being called by some the Burstyn Rule. Unfortunate because it really has little to do with this wonderful actress. Mike Schneider is TV editor for Variety, and he broke the story about this and other changes to Emmy Award rules. Mike Schneider, welcome to The Business.
Hey, Claude. How's it going?
Never better than now, my friend. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So last week you had a nice scoop in the paper, front page story about planned revisions to the Academy of Television and their Emmy Awards rules. Tell me exactly what is the scoop and what is the Ellen Burstyn Rule?
Well, it's sort of the annual rites of spring. The TV Academy every year tweaks their rules. Some years they're bigger than others, and there's several this year that are pretty interesting. The Ellen Burstyn Rule comes out of last year. Ellen was nominated for an Emmy, even though she appeared all of 14 seconds in the movie that she was nominated in.
Now, this movie was Mrs. Harris, which was an HBO
sort of mini or special, I guess.
Exactly. Right? And basically, you know, her name starts with a B. She was at the top of the list. People saw her name. She's just one of those perennials. Hey, Ellen Burstyn, she's a fine actress. Why don't we nominate her?
I loved her in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and she was great in Requiem for a Dream. I'm sure she was great in this.
Exactly. For all 14 seconds, you know, it was maybe all in the face.
Does she even have any lines?
Well, this is one of those things. I believe she had maybe one or two. You know, they basically, when they shove all the nominees out there, they sort of just hand a roster of these are all the people who starred in this production. So they're all eligible. So mm-hmm. they just shove those names in. So
did the producers, you know, demand that she be nominated even though she'd only done 14 seconds on the screen?
There was no demanding. There was sort of just her name was out there, you know, along with everyone else's name. And for some reason, you know, when people were sitting at home looking at the massive list of people to nominate, they saw her name. Hey, she's great. And she ended up, it was a fluke. It's something that probably should have never happened, but somehow it did. And her name ended up there among the top five nominees.
Mm-hmm. So what is the rule now?
So the rule is going forward, if you're a supporting actor or an actress in a TV movie or miniseries, you got to appear in at least 5% of the movie. So if you think of a two-hour movie, 5%, that's probably about 16 or so minutes, give or take. So, you know, because not many people are sort of policing this. You know, when you get down to an obscure category like a supporting actor or actress in a TV movie or miniseries, you know, mistakes like that can sort of creep in. So now they're just sort of formally saying you better have, you know, done more than sort of lifted a finger and raised an eyebrow.
Right. So now, of course, this sort of rule change doesn't really have much effect. It's more to, I guess, prevent embarrassment, like of the kind that we're creating for them right now. But there were other rule changes that probably will have decidedly important effects on the marketing of TV shows. Tell me about the other rule change.
Well, my favorite rule change is the essay rule. The Emmys suddenly is adding a sort of an SAT sort of you know, requisite you know, part of if you're going to be nominated, you have to include a 250 word or less essay explaining the episode that you're submitting. What's going on in this episode, and if you're an actor, so what's going on with your character? So
now this isn't a last ditch effort to catch some AP credit that was, you know, missed in high school or something. What's the real reason for this?
Well, the real reason is, again, last year, a show like Lost didn't get nominated because the episode they submitted was smack dab in the middle of the season. If you're not watching the show regularly, you have no idea what's going on. And if you're sitting in there in the blue ribbon panel, which is where they actually decide these nominations, if you haven't seen the show, it's going over your head. You're not voting for it. So shows like Lost and this year Heroes are sort of stymied by that. So,
so it was favoring sort of procedural dramas like CSI and to the detriment of episodic television.
Exactly. So this year, you know, if you can maybe explain it a little bit more, then that might help your cause.
Anything else interesting?
Well, they're also sort of changing, actually, how people are nominated and shows are nominated. Last year, it was all a blue ribbon panel, which generally the people who show up at these blue ribbon panels, it's one weekend in July, you know, at the TV Academy. It's people who've got a lot of time on their hands, and so that may not be the best sort of a cross-section of who should be voting on these nominations. So this year, it's a 50-50 split. 50% of the nominations will be coming out of just the Academy body at large, people voting at home. The other 50% will be from these blue ribbon panels, the people who spend a weekend or so watching all these shows, watching all these nominees, and deciding who should be nominated.
It's nice to know that all the weekends I spent sort of wasting away in front of the cathode tube actually makes me a winner at something. I'm apparently eligible at least to be on a blue ribbon panel.
Yeah, the difference is you weren't actually doing it for a blue ribbon panel. You were just sitting at home wasting away your life.
Yeah. Well, there's that. Mike Schneider is the television editor of Variety. He always makes me feel better about my job. Mike, thanks for being on The Business.
Anytime, Claude.
In a recent TV ad campaign, voiceover giant Don LaFontaine steps in front of the camera.
Paula Sela is a real Geico customer, not an actor. So to help tell her story, we hired that announcer guy from the movies.
When the storm hit, both our cars were totally underwater.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater,
we thought it would take forever to get some help.
But a new wind was about to blow.
With Geico, we had our check in 2 days.
Payback. This time, it's for real.
Geico. Real service, real savings.
But for the most part, voiceover artists stay in their little booths, selling you Nissan Sentras, trying to get you to tune into that next episode of Grey's Anatomy, and occasionally making you laugh as the voice of a character in an animated movie or TV show. Though more and more high-profile stars are stepping behind the mic for a quick payday, it's still a mostly anonymous, if highly skilled, profession. We thought we'd give voiceover the once-over with Jerry Ryba, a voiceover agent with CESD, the largest commercial talent agency in the world. Jerry Ryba, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
So it's just reading copy, right? I mean, voiceover, I have a mellifluously toned voice, I'm told. Why am I not earning the big bucks, right?
Well, everyone thinks they can do it. They go to the grocery store and the clerk says, oh, you have a great voice. You should be doing voiceover. And it's not the case. You have to bring copy to life, like Nissan, the car of the future.
Should I do Nissan, car of the future for you? Because I feel like I'm sitting on a pile of cash here and I just don't even realize it.
It could happen for you.
Yeah? Nissan, the car of the future.
Brilliant.
So but why is that obviously not acceptable for it? Let's just take it apart, if you wouldn't mind.
It is how you work your voice in terms of how you can paint the picture, more or less, as they say. You have to think that you're not selling to mass people, but you're selling to that one person in their car or sitting at their home. For example, like our client, Sean Donnell, and it's a really good voiceover artist. He's really hot right now in terms of a guy who's this comfortable guy in his 30s and how he just sells a bunch of products at this point. So he's a good average guy.
Let's listen to him for a second.
Sure.
Anyway, I was somewhere between the cereal and the frozen dinners, dragging myself from aisle to aisle like a narcoleptic in a mattress store when I stumbled upon a Starbucks Frappuccino.
He really does sound like he's almost bored and just sort of talking to a friend as you're walking down the aisle. And I guess that ability to sort of seduce us into thinking that we know this guy, we're friendly with him, and that we're not being sold to is the reason why he's being paid so much to sell.
Exactly. And that's where the culture is right now in terms of how America is looking for people in the voiceover. That culture shifts every 6 months or so. As the economy changes, as the political arena changes, so does the way that voiceover is viewed. For example,
I'm sitting here with my mouth open a little bit. Every 6 months?
About every 6 months, you'll see a shift in terms of how the read is changed. And so,
and that's pegged to what, the consumer price index or how many loans are defaulting? I mean,
any of it. It could be anything in terms of any kind of event that happens, people's take on the war, how the economy is going right now. Your voiceover will change to kind of match that.
What happened to voiceover after September 11th?
It went – before September 11th, it was a lot more sarcastic. It was definitely a Dennis Leary type read. They were definitely a lot edgier. People kind of throw it in your face a little bit more, a little tough guy tough.
Because we'd been through the dot-com bubble
exactly.
bursting and we'd seen our 401k become a 201k. And
right, exactly.
People were snarky.
Right. And then all of a sudden – it was a kinder, gentle read. It was a much more smoother read. It's a very soothing read. It was kind of a calming, this is the way it is now and everything's going to be good. And that's the kind of read and it's what has shifted now since 9/11 has been kind of a much more, it's getting a little bit more edgier, but it will never be kind of as edgy as it was back before in 2000.
So how do I become a voiceover star?
You have to realize there's three different forms of voiceover. There's animation, there's commercial, there's promo, there's trailer, and there's narration, which is actually five. But promo, trailer,
I was going to say,
narration,
you know, that is, I'm not a math major, but that seemed like more than three.
There are five forms of it then. But promo, trailer, narration, usually those all kind of wind up together. In terms of the number of people that are involved in voiceover, the most of them are involved in commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the easiest and most random portion of it. I mean, it's a lot of copy reading. A lot of auditions take place when we get a piece of copy in. You may have 600 to 700 people read on one piece of copy. When you go into animation, then it's a much smaller market, and they get three voices for one payment.
So you're always going to be wearing three hats, really.
Exactly. You could have conversations with yourself in two different or three different characters. And then there's the promo and trailer stuff, which is, you know, that coming up next on NBC.
And that's sort of the most rarefied group.
That's the least amount of people in that making the most amount of money.
So how do you choose who to represent? Do you just get something in the mail and listen to it and say, great?
I think we get about 100 CDs and MP3s a week. We probably out of those 100 CDs that we get and MP3s get in a week, we probably maybe out of the course of the year maybe take on two. But a lot of the people that we do get sent to us that we do take on have been recommended through a manager or through another voiceover talent and have had a lot of experience at this point. And we've had clients of ours who we've taken from managers who were in the theatrical world, who've given up their theatrical careers because they can make a much more sustainable and lucrative career in voiceover than they can theatrically. Because for us, it doesn't matter what you look like, if you gain weight, lose your hair, you know, put on a toupee, whatever you want to do. As long as you can read copy and your voice doesn't change, you're good to go.
What am I making?
You know, voiceover varies, but I would say we have clients anywhere from making $100,000 a year to $1 million or more a year. It's not like a theatrical career where you have talent come in and all of a sudden they get that one pilot break and they take off and all of a sudden they're the new star in Grey's Anatomy. But you can have someone that gets several different accounts throughout the year and probably has a nice six-figure income for the rest of their life.
I want to just sort of explore a little bit about what you do for a living.
Okay.
And how you do what you do. What exactly does a regular talent agent do that you don't do?
Well, there's theatrical agents, there's literary agents, there's all different types of agents. As a voiceover agent, we audition every day in our studios. We have four booths that run all day long, and we audition the copy that comes in commercially and animation-wise. In the promo trailer world, there's very little auditioning. That's a whole different set where we do pitching, where you have it's all based on your demo.
So I voice the trailer for Lord of the Rings, you might just play that for them and say, well, this is the guy who did Lord of the Rings. Maybe you want him to do your Little Dragon movie.
Maybe he would be great for the new Spielberg picture or something like that. We deal with the different studios out there and say, hey, we have this guy. He's really hot right now. He's someone that you should probably want to be looking for. Are you working on something new that would be good for him? And we send the demo off with that. Commercially, we audition all the time, every day.
Walk us through some of the different types of clients, describing them, if you would.
Well, for example, if everyone's talking about the promo world, we have our client Jonathan Cook, who's on several different networks like FX, and we can play his demo. You can see how he sounds.
Saturday, next Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, only on FX,
Bravo,
NBC,
CBS.
Hit by a car and left for dead. But the real secret to this murder is hiding in his brain.
I've never heard Thursday sound so ominous.
So sexy in a way.
So, yeah.
But that's, you know, that's what the networks are looking for. They're looking for something strong like that to get those people to rush into their show.
How would we describe that type of voice? Is there a slang term for it in the business?
Not really. Deep pipes.
Yeah, okay. Give me another example of someone who is
in
the stable.
There's a guy, Hal Douglas, who is really good, and he's strong in terms of doing movie trailers.
Never before has the reality of the ultimate sacrifice hit so close to home.
At our house, he is the known soldier, and we're proud to know him.
A Seventh Heaven landmark event on the WB Monday.
So what we're hearing here is someone who has the ability to instill a sense of grandeur. But
Hal also has a sense of trustworthiness. Hal has a way of interpreting words and the way he controls his breathing and says certain phrases that give you like a certain sense of smile and a little happiness to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what helps him sell those kind of comedies like that.
As somebody is doing these things, are they getting direction?
Yes. The networks have a certain vision, or the studios like Nickelodeon or Warner Brothers, whatever, have a certain vision in terms of what they want with their characters. Also, as people audition for this and before it even goes to air, the animators have given you an idea of what this character is going to look like. That's the same with the movies as it is for the shows. So they come and the voiceover artists come and create a character for that. And what ends up happening sometimes from the audition to the time it gets on the air, it gets manipulated. They'll get a lot of direction that way. There's a lot more stronger direction in terms of animation work than there is probably in commercials or promos. Promos and trailers is definitely very directed. They want to bring a certain presence that's going to complement this picture and to get people to go to the movies. So there's a stronger – those two are probably the most heavily directed areas in our area. Commercial, if a guy gets it, it's going to be a little more relaxed and they'll just go to town on it. So you give it your take and then they may want to direct it because they want a little bit faster. They want a little bit more smile. They want it to be happier. They want you to be flatter. They want you to extend it. And that would be the direction in which they give you. We had a guy that said, I want this to be – give me a little more mint chip. What that means, I don't know, but our client delivered it. Mint chip. I want this read with a scoop of mint chip.
Okay. Well,
you know, you could – that's how random some of the direction can be.
More about the shadowy world of voiceover with Agent Jerry Ryba after a short break. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
the Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Voiceover is nice work if you can get it. It doesn't make a difference what you look like or how you dress, as long as you can make the copy sing. A working voiceover person can make a cushy living doing nothing more than standing in a booth and reading out loud. If only it was that easy. Jerry Ryba is a voiceover agent with CESD, the largest commercial talent agency in the world.
Are they seeing what they're saying often, or are they flying blind?
In animation, you're flying blind. In promo trailer, you're probably reading the picture many times.
I wonder, because this is fundamentally is not just voicing something. It's acting. It's performing on a certain level as well. If this business is bifurcated into drama and comedy, that is, are there the Adam Sandlers of voiceover who do not then take the roles that are usually taken by the Tom Hanks of voiceover?
Definitely. For example, when we listen to Jonathan Cook, he's got a much deeper pipe and he's much a stronger dramatic read, where Hal Douglas deals mostly with the friendly romantic comedy situations. In animation, we have a woman, Vanessa Marshall, who plays a black boy on a show called Billy and Mandy.
Oh, sassy cat! You're second only to Mandy in my heart, yo!
Are you ready for love? That special someone could be waiting just for you at Match.com.
Just like you have people in your life that are funny and other people that aren't, it's kind of the same way in terms of voiceover.
It's sort of amusing to mention or to use that analogy of Adam Sandler and Tom Hanks, because the question I also wanted to ask you was how celebrity has started to infiltrate what was a previously fairly anonymous area of work called voiceover.
Right.
I mean, I'm thinking of Julia Roberts doing The Voice of America Online.
Right.
You've got Gene Hackman doing Oppenheimer Funds.
Sometimes with celebrities getting involved in the business, it's the CEOs or CFOs or whomever involved with that want to say, hey, well, I played golf or I spoke to Sean Connery online today. So that's part of it. And it's also then because they're such a large corporation that they want to have that name value with it. For example, our client, James Garner, did a lot of work for Chevy, and car accounts always have usually a celebrity attached to it.
If you're heading out there, I'll give you a tip. It's wild and it's far, and you're in for a trip. For just when you think it couldn't get rougher, the path goes crooked and the going gets tougher.
So does James Garner get different copy than the average bear?
No, but you have in our business, there are sometimes they want to use celebrities and sometimes they don't. Most of the time they don't. The bulk of the business is just with our average guys here and there. The celebrity business is more or less your blue chip companies that want to add a celebrity flair to it. They've got extra money that they want to put in their advertising budget, so they feel that someone like a Robert Redford or Gene Hackman or James Garner can sell their product and make people want to go and get a Chevy Tahoe or fly United or go to Lowe's.
Do they get paid ridiculous amounts of money compared with someone else who would have done the job, or is it, you know, are they making whatever?
Definitely. I mean, celebrities get paid a celebrity rate. There's, you know, most people that are in the voiceover business, unless you're somewhat well-known in the voiceover business, are getting paid as scale performers. You can make a very nice living as a scale performer, but you'll never have a celebrity-type rate. And it all really depends on the number of commercials that they do, the number of sessions, the volume of spots they have to do, and how many markets it runs in.
If I'm a celebrity who's voicing, you know, Chevy or Chrysler, right, or something, am I making millions?
Probably not millions, although I think Julie Roberts got paid a little over $1 million to do AOL. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but, you know, you're definitely getting paid to be who you are to sell that product.
And who represents them then? Is it their sort of native talent agency, or do you handle that?
We would handle that. We have a nice celebrity list, as a lot of other agencies that are involved in voiceovers do.
Let's talk about what's the lifestyle like if I'm working as a voiceover person. Am I sort of feverishly running from one job to the next, or is it the sort of thing where I work an hour in the morning and then?
It really depends. On the promo trailer guys work the most because if you're on a network or whatever, you're probably working 6 or 7 times a day. As a commercial artist, depending on how often you're working, every session is between 1 hour to 2 hours at a time. So you can do a number of sessions a day depending on what kind of campaigns or what kind of random radio spots that come up. Animation-wise, people can usually do about 2 shows a day because it's a 4-hour session for each one. So depending on your volume work, You could work 1 hour in a course of a week and make $60,000 off a commercial spot because it runs on television. It all really depends then on the media buy. If you work on a national network television spot and that spot runs for its complete 21-month cycle then at that point, then you can make a decent chunk of change off that. But during that time, you don't want to just base all your – you put all your eggs in that basket because you're going to continue auditioning. So you're going to stop in your agent's office and audition every day, provided that there's copy available to you, and then you're going to hopefully book those jobs.
I mean, you sort of addressed this early on in that you said that the zeitgeist kind of changes every 6 months based on what's going on in the economy and in both politics and in Wall Street and people's pocketbook issues, that kind of thing. But I'm curious how things have sort of evolved, like what the grand sort of evolution of voiceover is. If you were to look at, you know, these sort of big announcerly Don Pardo, that's right, Jim, you know, kind of.
Well, play our client Bill Woodson. You'll hear what his voiceover was. He was the guy that was in 1972 that did the lead-in for The Odd Couple.
On November 13th, Felix Unger was asked to remove himself from his place of residence. That request came from his wife.
Miller Lite knows that if you can combine great taste and less filling, you can combine anything, like an amateur electrician and a toaster.
That was Bill Woodson doing himself, essentially, as the voice he invented as the straight man.
Right.
In The Odd Couple. And he's sort of been William Shatnerized in that everything is old as new again, but it's funny.
It's the parodies now, exactly. So when you want those big announcer guys like that, they're looking for those kind of parodies. It's a joke now at this point, as opposed to what started back in the 50s and 60s in terms of how they – that was how you sold products, you know. That's how television started, with the big announcer guys who were the former radio guys, and that's what he was at one point.
What came next?
I think the celebrity market opened up a lot more then at that point for people. I think as television grew and the glamour of the 80s has left, and then you kind of moved into the 90s and the Seinfeld era kind of put a lot more real people in there. And then when reality television kicked in, it opened up the voiceover market all over the place, because Americans got used to not hearing actors or voiceover actors on their commercial copy. And then they got used to seeing people on television as just regular people who could be their neighbor on a game show type format. So as they got used to hearing their voices, they wanted to hear regular people who would be your neighbor selling you cars or beer or whatever.
Now, just because I have you here and I'm holding you prisoner in this studio and you must answer my questions, I'm just going to – I want to see if you – what your voiceover knowledge of trivia is.
Okay.
So if I throw out a commercial, you can give me a name.
Okay.
Pillsbury Doughboy.
I don't know who that is. But the Pillsbury Doughboy has probably gone through several different people.
Okay. Fair enough.
You know, like the Keebler – the guy who's been the Keebler Elf for a long period of time recently passed away, so now they're going to replace him.
So the original Keebler Elf – God rest his soul.
The real Ernie.
The real Ernie has passed away.
Yes.
And we have a new Ernie?
Not yet.
Parquet Margarine.
That was our client, Michael Bell. He said butter.
I miss him, for whatever it's worth.
They don't make those spots anymore.
Yeah, I know. Jerry Ryba is an agent at CESD, the largest commercial talent agency in the world. Jerry, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Orson, you did 6 last year, and by far and away the best, and I know the reason.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
At the moment.
I spent 20 times more for you people than any other commercial I've ever made. You are such pests. Now, what is it you want?
No, I think
in your depths of your ignorance, what is it you want? Whatever it is you want, I can't deliver because I just don't see it.
That was absolutely fine. It really was.
You can't
give me
worth it. No money is worth it.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More at acura.com/RDX.